Well, at my very early life, the age of 6 months, I fell out of my high chair and I landed headfirst on a plastic paddle boat. You could say I was acquainted with boats from a very early age. Family holidays were always at harbours and seaside, and when the family often visited Hastings, where my grandmother lived, we used the Tilbury Ferry, which, as a steam-fired paddle boat as it was then, used to fascinate me. I didn't know whether to look at the river or the bustling Thames or the engine room with all the crank rods flying round and little men in, or with oil cans. Just fascinating. At Hastings, I used to watch the fishing boats landing on the beach and unloading their catch. And there was a large lake where at the age of six, I first drove a small motorboat. So I started quite early, I suppose. My father built a canvas-covered boat at home when I was about eight, and we took it on the roof of his car all the way to Wells in Norfolk. The most awful thing, returned home to be a garden waste bin. My father and I then went to Gravesend to view a small yacht, the Farm. In 1958, after the great storm which washed out the arterial and flooded Wickford and so on, we tried to drive through Wickford and there was a double-decker bus up to its lower windows in water. So it was quite a big flood. And we got to Fanbridge and there were bales of hay floating down the river where they'd been washed out the fields. Anyway, we found a 32-foot, 10-ton catch, a bit like a barge yacht with leeboards. And the boat was moved to Lee-on-Sea and then in 1960 to Maldon, where my parents had bought a house in Spittle Road from Christopher Pay. He was a local schoolmaster. Everything was chocolate brown and cream paint inside. It was pretty dire. And in fact, two walls, the plaster was so bad that it covered it with sacking and rendered over it again. We had a local builder from Fanbridge Road who, J.J. Furlong, he did the remedial work. And I remember his brass plate outside had at the bottom artesian well engineer, which fascinated me. I remember our telephone number was only three digits. And when you picked up the phone, the operator in the exchange in Tenterfield Road asked you who you wished to call, just like the old days, really. My father kept his boat at Heybridge Basin at Pops and Curly Hiscox, and they became great friends. Part of the boat yacht became known as the Quarter Deck Cafe. I had my dinghy there as well. I had my own personal rowing boat. I spent a lot of time at Heybridge Basin in the early 60s and used to climb all over Brown's timber lighters, which were 14 in number ex-sailing barges, and the huge stacks of timber in the large black shed by the canal. In 1964, Brown's decided to enlarge the lock so the timber ships didn't have to unload off Osey Island into the lighters. So these lighters became redundant and were sold off. The cheapest went for £12.50 and the best for £400. And several of them have been restored back to sail and are still sailing today. The Malden-built Myrosa, the Malden-built Dawn, Centre, Kitty and the George Smead. I also used to watch the live eels being unloaded and you always knew when a tanker load had been dispatched to Billingsgate because of the grey-white blobs of smelly foam on the road out from the Heybridge village. You'd be cycling in and it'd be this big blob of foam in the road which smelt rather not very nice. To maintain their fleet of ex-sailing barges, Browns had built a set of barge blocks on the foreshore about 600 yards downstream from the lock. I put my barge William Cleverly, which also had been a lighter for Browns, on these blocks for maintenance and found about 2 foot of mud around them. And as Dilbury Clark, one of the locals in the basin, told me, you get tired just doing nothing. In about 1968-1970, I leased these barge blocks from Morgan Council for £40 a year. I had my first rowing dinghy at the age of 10, but shortly after 1960, I bought a beautiful 8-foot mahogany clinker dinghy from Dixon Curley's, which were on the Downs Road yard, which I kept for many years, rowing down to Osey Island in it many times, sometimes on my own, sometimes with friends, and also spent hours walking over the marshes and saltings and listening to the skylarks and enjoying the peace and the open expanse. By the time I was 14, I was doing a paper round for May and Brett's, which used to be down Malden High Street, and throughout the bad winter of 1963, and with the money I earned from this, I bought a small clinker motorboat with a little cabin lying at Ben Clark's yard, West Mersey. After painting it up, it was duly launched on Mersey Hard and tried to sink, and it was only by dint of much bailing that it didn't sink. The engine was a Stuart Turner 1.5 horsepower, and it never properly recovered, so thereafter the few voyages in that boat made were powered by an outboard. The boat was so bad underneath, I named it Patch, as it had so many patches on it. At the age of 15, I left school and was apprenticed to Cardinal Brothers at Maylandsea, building fairly high-class wooden yachts. Who were building wooden yachts? I used to cycle from Malden to Maylandsea every day, rain and shine, ice and snow. About that time, my father, who was a marine paint sales representative, decided he wanted to buy a recently disused railway station in Cornwall. My mother bought me the recently unrigged sailing barge William Cleverly for £25 so that I could live on it at Maylandsea and continue my apprenticeship. I don't know what she was thinking of, really, because a 15-year-old living on his own on an old barge. The barge leaked through the top and the bottom. I had grand ideas of restoring it back to sail again, but it never happened. Barge was moored near Brush's Crane at Heybridge Basin, and after about 3 years, came to my senses and realised that it was never going to sail again, and I sold it for £150. A few years later, the barge finished up on the dump at Malden and was burnt, but the bottom is still visible to this day. My parents didn't move away. I stayed at Cardinal Brothers for another 4 years until they stopped building wooden boats, and I started fitting out fiberglass hulls. I didn't care much for this and did the last year of my apprenticeship at Frost and Drake's at Tollesbury, they treated me absolutely like family, where they built two wooden fishing vessels in my time there for Rye, Sussex. The first was the Kerrigan, a 40-foot stern trawler, and was then the smallest stern trawler built in Britain. And it was powered by Ford marine diesel. And surprisingly, it had a large write-up in the Ford Times, which apparently is an in-house magazine they publish. The second fishing boat built there was a side trawler called Misty Lights, and was one plank lower in the top sides to aid the hauling of the nets over the side. Then I diversified a bit, went off in a different direction, I suppose, and I got a job as mate on a 380-ton coaster, and I was about 20 then, owned by Civil and Marine, which was a firm that was a Malden-based firm owned by John Hobbins. And we were employed in the ballast trade, trading to Ramsgate, Dover, Whitstable, Gillingham, but after a while, primarily from Brightlingsea to Wandsworth, which was under about 17 bridges each way, which I didn't much care for. We were carrying 3 freights a week, and this didn't leave much home time in Malden. Most times we would sail at midnight Sunday, so as to be up at Wandsworth for 7 a.m. discharge. At Wandsworth, we would arrive with the flood tide, the crane would discharge us, and we would leave on the same tide. Only 2 or 3 times in a year did we finish on a Saturday before midday. After a year of this, I dead on my feet, so came ashore and slept for about 2 weeks. Shortly after this, I decided to buy a boat to go diving with in the Channel Islands, and I found a 56-foot teak X-steam twin-engine motorboat called Sea Lion laying at Twickenham, and I bought it rather unwisely, as it turned out. Going back to the boat Sea Lion that I bought at Twickenham, rather unwisely, we decided to sail that night. We never had checked the engine or anything, whether there was any oil in the gearboxes or anything. Anyway, it was an epic trip down the Thames, such which included the engine stopping frequently, sailing over the top of Richmond Weir in the middle of the night. We didn't even know it was there. And then we realised when we got down off Sion House that we must have gone over it. So that was kind of a little cherub looking after us, I think. And somewhere near the Houses of Parliament, the port navigation light caught light on the wheelhouse roof. So I was at the wheel steering, trying to get it through all the bridges with the tide sloshing out. And the rest of the crew were panicking because the top of the boat was on fire. At the Isle of Dogs, we'd had enough and got a friendly coaster to tow us to East Mersey. And 2 days later, I got Cecil Stebbings from Heybridge Basin, and I towed the Sea Lion back in Heybridge Basin, where initially I moored her in the canal, but later on moved her to a mooring at Fulbridge, where I 50% rebuilt her, including all new decks, beams, cabin sides and cabin top. Brush Marine were short of a crew for some of their barges. Brush Marine at that time were working from Fallbridge as part of AJ Brushster at the gravel pit at Heybridge. And they had a shortage of crew. They had four coasters and no crew. So, and they were based at Fallbridge. I then took an ex-sailing barge that they owned, Britannic, over to Kent, loaded with sand and shingle for them. And that was when they were building the M2 flyover bridge across the Medway. So a lot of Malden shingle was in the M2 flyover bridge. So, and quite a few thousand tonnes, I suspect. Later on, I was then mate on another ship owned by them, the Bill Brush, a 220-tonne coaster, and working from Fallbridge quite a lot of the time. Bill Brush was an ex-naval ship, had accommodation for 9 crew, but we sailed with just 2. And I later worked as relief skipper for the Bill, or on the Bill Brush. We decided at one point that it was foolish to return back to Malden with the Bill Brush empty every time. So every freight we did to wherever we were going, we were loaded. And when we came back, we were empty. And obviously it's better if you can get paid both ways. So we managed to fix 3 freights of grain back to Malden for Green's flour mill, which meant an awful lot of sweeping to get all the gravel out, because gravel and grain wouldn't be very kind to their mills. This caused ructions with another shipping company based in Kent, and they basically wanted to black the port of Malden if we carried on. So they said they would black the port of Malden if we didn't stop. So sadly, we had to stop bringing grain to Malden. They wanted their ships to do it, not us. So that was... Anyway, a bit later I left. I set up my own firm. I'd left barges and coasting and decided I wanted to spend a little more time at home rather than being away 6.5 days a week. I set up my own firm and I got a job refitting a sailing barge, the CIV, which had been laying in a while in the Albert Dock Basin in London. As we left the dock, the owner was at the wheel, fortunately for me, and collided with the lock gate, putting a large hole in the bow. I was standing on the bow with the fender, and it pushed the fender right through the hull into the cabin inside the boat, inside the barge. Fortunately, the hole was well above the waterline. I took the CIV out the lock, the owner was pretty shaken up by it, and up to the barge blocks at Tate and Lyle Refinery at Silvertown, where there was a set of barge blocks. I put a large patch over the hole, and 3 days later, I brought the CIV round to Heybridge Basin, parked it round the back of where the tea rooms now are, and I spent about 6 months putting a new bow in the barge, and lots of other work as well, but lots of other structural work. And poor old thing, basically I think I could have gone right round to the stern and then right round the other side, but and barge has been long dead now. When we'd finished and the barge was sort of seaworthy, I took it back up to St Catherine's Dock by the Tower Bridge, and there I fitted out the interior for the owner so he could live aboard. Later, the CIV came back to Malden for several of the Blackwater barge matches. Then, after that, about 1975-76, I got a job in St Catherine's Dock of re-rigging the 96-foot sailing barge Jock, which is about the same size as the Hydrogen, which you probably know from the quay. And I sailed her, I re-rigged her over about a year and a bit, and sailed her in the Medway barge match that year. Then I got married in 1976 to a local farmer's daughter who owned 4 farms over at Munden. And for a few months we lived on the Sea Line, which I still owned, at Fallbridge, later buying a house in Tollesbury. Sea Line was moved to Tollesbury and lay out in the marshes near the lightship. I'd rebuilt 2 wooden sailing yachts of about 32 foot for a Danbury owner, and he expressed an interest in buying a sailing fishing smack. I knew one called the Penbith, which in the 60s used to lay in Heybridge Basin, and it's now laying at Woodbridge, and it could have been looking for a new owner. So anyway, went up there with the owner, and when we ran the bowsprit out, that frightened him, so he decided not to buy the Penbith. A month or two later, the current owner of the smack Penbith contacted me to carry out some repairs on her at Woodbridge. So I was back up to Woodbridge. Penbith was out of the water, and nearby was the hulk of a large 53-foot smack called Telegraph, built in 1906. Telegraph was completely gutted, just the shell, and was due to be broken up in a few months' time as the owner had lost interest. Most lunchtimes I would wander over to Telegraph and after a short time realise that she was still structurally fairly sound, but cosmetically awful. Boatyard were desperate to rid themselves of Telegraph. They'd offered it to the Americans as a bombing target in Wainfleet. They hoped the Americans would pick it up with a helicopter and take it there. The Americans said, sure, you get it there, we'll bomb it. They'd also thought of skinning it in polythene, floating it down the river somewhere and dumping it. So they were very keen when I stuck my neck in on the block. And I brokered a deal with the boatyard and I bought her for £1 and other considerations, which was the problem. Namely that she left the boatyard within 6 weeks, either as firewood or a whole boat, and also left the River Deben and never returned. The boatyard's been bust for some years and they've built houses there now, so I guess that doesn't apply anymore. But I re-caulked the whole of the bottom. I re-nailed it first, re-nailed the whole of the bottom using about 200 or 300 weight of galvanised special nails, boat nails. And then I re-caulked it with oakum, using a whole bale of it, which is about the size of a hay bale. And then I stopped it over with red lead putty, and I had to make it up myself. And I used 1.5 hundred weight red lead putty. Not because the seams were big, just because the boat took 7 foot of water to float, and there was a lot of boat to stop the seams. 6 weeks and one day later, Telegraph was relaunched and didn't leak a drop. A shipwright friend of mine remarked, well, Colin, I reckon you did a proper job there, in his best Suffolk accent. In October that year, that same friend and I towed Telegraph round from Woodbridge to Tollesbury with an open fishing boat, and it was so cold that we took it in turns to sit on the engine to try and warm up. I made a new 50-foot wooden mainmast for Telegraph, and about this time sold Sea Lion. I had 2 50-foot boats, and I couldn't afford one, let alone two. And with that money, had a complete new suit of sails made for Telegraph. About a year later, I had Telegraph hauled out on the slipway at Maidensea, and I worked full time on her for 4 months, renewing the whole of the stern. And I made a new rudder, which was 14 feet long, 3 foot wide, and about 6 inch thick. Made it out of pitch pine, I was lucky to get that. And then towed Telegraph to Maldon and moored her in Canada Dock at the end of the promenade, where I spent another year making her fit to sail. About this time, the lower smack mooring on the Bath wall became free, and I got permission to moor her there, which is pretty well up on the corner by the end of what was the swimming pool, where the kiosks are. And she lay there for every winter. I use that as a winter mooring. In the summer, she'd be moored further down the river, but I used that as a winter mooring. She lay there for about 12 years, so it became a feature of the... And a lot of photographs of Telegraph in the foreground and church and everything behind the Maldon on its hill, so...
You called it the smack mooring. Is that where...
They were all smack moorings on the Bath wall.
Right.
So they were from Cook's Yard down to the sort of corner, were about 14 moorings for Maldon fishermen on the Bath wall, and... In my childhood, or my youth, the Maldon fishermen still used to have boats. They worked then, and they used to keep the foreshore clean. I believe it's called looting, as in L-U-T-E, and they used a wooden board on a pole. They used to wash the mud down, sort of puggle the mud, agitate the mud in as it was settling out. And they'd wash it down, and that kept the beach clean, and you could walk down to the middle of the river on ordinary shoes almost.
I'm sure you're right. There's a lot of people will know that view.
Yes, there's been quite a bit of debate about that on Facebook and things like that. But I've got old pictures of Maldon taken about 1910, or perhaps a bit earlier, and the other side of the river was all clean shingle. And in living memory, that has always had 5 or 6 foot of mud over it. It's called Net Lambwood Drift. And apparently the mud gets agitated, say, off the Denji, picked up by the waves, brought up the river, gets nice and calm, all drops out, water goes back nice and clean to pick up more mud. And so it can put as much as 1/4 inch of mud over an area on a tide, so it can build up very quickly. And then once it's consolidated down, then you get problems. And when you get plants growing in it, marsh plants, then you've really got problems because it doesn't go. So back to Telegraph, where were we? Oh, yes. I never got round to fitting an engine in Telegraph. I had an engine, but I didn't fit it. and I sailed telegraph to festivals in Portsmouth twice and another time to Gravelines in France, where the French, I discovered, don't like boats without large boats without engines. They weren't very helpful at all, actually, but some years later, the TV film producer Toby Roberts wanted to make a TV documentary about an original fishing smack and others that had been especially rebuilt for racing to highlight the differences. His father, who was also a film producer, had earlier owned a smack called Primrose, which was very original and I think sank on him once. That's got original too, isn't it, I suppose. Telegraph was used as the original smack and Katie as the much modified rebuilt smack. There were scenes filmed on the Hythe Quay at Maldon, off Mersey and Brabble, and in the sea view bar of the Queen's Head. Toby Roberts had put a tab behind the bar and after half an hour was shocked to find it was already at over £80. I have a DVD of this film somewhere. So it was a half hour slot on ITV or something, I think. Some years later, the Sailing Smack Association was formed in Maldon Little Ship Club and I became its third chairman, in which position I remained for about 4 years. At the same time, I was also on the National Sailing Committee of the Old Gaffers Association, and again, I did that for a few years. I've always taken an interest in old barge wrecks and other working boats, and at that time, it was considered rather a strange thing to do. I wasn't a mudlark. You get those on the Thames, and now they have to be licensed, but they're just used to poke around old, poor old wrecks and wonder what they'd be like. And now this has the grand title of intertidal and foreshore archaeology, and there are even courses on how to do it and methodology run by Citizen through MOLA. MOLA is the Museum of London Archaeology, and as such I've had meetings with staff from Citizen both in Maldon and at Heybridge Basin, and some of my data has been used in the ITV series Britain at Low Tide, and I appeared in the credits in very small letters for Citizen. I collect lantern slides and now have 400 or 500 lantern slides of barges and fishing smacks, and I even have a couple of lantern slide projectors as well in their original leather cases. Just need to find time to collate it into a lantern slide show. I also have my own archive of sailing barge photographs, which must number over 1,000. I've never counted, so I don't really know. And I use these to write small articles for two specialist magazines relating to barges. Going back to Telegraph, it's laid up at Heybridge Basin, awaiting a third restoration, and hopefully this can be achieved soon, as she's now 115 years old, and she then can go on for another 100 years, hopefully.
Will you do that yourself? Or?
I think I'm too old and decrepit now. The boat could be repaired, I can't. Unfortunately, I had a heart attack 8 years ago and I have other problems. So might be better to let somebody else do it. I was also, for my sins, and sailed in some of the early Maldon Town Regattas. I had a Merlin racing dinghy then, number 15, which was built by Jack Holt himself, quite a famous man. It was a 14-foot long varnished clinker-built dinghy, and I was a member of the Maldon Little Ship Club for many years, and finally serving as dinghy secretary for some of those. The old regatta committee at Maldon, I knew them all, but they retired, resigned, didn't want to run the regatta anymore. And after a few years later, I and a group of friends restarted Maldon Town Regatta in about 1976. I didn't actually want to be chairman, but I was the one who spoke the most and said, what a shame, and I sort of voted myself into the position. So I ran Maldon Town Regatta for 3 or 4 years, ably assisted by a small crew. We had to fund it using the Maldon Little Ship Club as a basis. We had to fund it ourselves. We didn't have any funding, but one of the nice things we were able to do is get the Mayor of Maldon down to present the prizes. That was traditional from all the earlier regattas. So then there was a lapse of a few years and a couple of friends of mine then ran it, and then I think the current committee have picked it up again, and Maldon Regatta is running nearly every year, so that's good that tradition has been sort of retained, if you like, or restored or whatever, resurrected. Telegraph herself, going back to that, I'm jumping about a bit, sorry about that. Telegraph is on the National Historic Ships Register, part of the Historic Fleet, and is considered a vessel of historic and vernacular importance, and one of only about 50 vessels on that list that are members of this historic fleet. And I'm allowed to, as a member of this select group, to fly a special ensign defaced with the coronet. Well, I discovered it cost over 100 quid to buy the flag, so it hasn't happened. So, where are we? Oh, sorry, yes. Thank you. When we double back again, about 1986, I designed and built a wooden 40-foot fishing boat for a Swansea owner, and worked on a Bristol Channel pilot cutter, the Olga, for the city of Swansea. That was at the time, that was at Tollesbury. And the fishing boat, I believe, is still going, and it's now fishing out the Tor Bay, but it's nice to check up and see if it's still in existence. And I built, it was quite nice building that boat. The owner said, or the guy who wanted it built, he said, I like this boat very much. And then we went and looked at a boat down in Saundersfoot or somewhere, I think, and I photographed it, and there were several things I said, well, I think we can do better than that, and we can do better than that. And anyway, went back and built this boat, which worked very well, and it was quite gratifying for me to basically take a dream from his head and translate it into reality. And he still liked me at the end of it, so it obviously did work. I had a friend who was a car dealer, and he said people tend to dislike you or hate you afterwards because the car doesn't live up to the dream. But fortunately, this boat obviously did live up to the dream, and he kept it for quite a few years. I also did work for the city of Swansea on the Olga, the pilot cutter, and then I restored considerable amount of restoration on a 1906 8-metre class racing yacht, which is quite rare. And I fitted out, unfortunately I had to do some fibreglass work. I became licensed builder for a Kentish firm, Tyler Boat Co., who were at the time one of the biggest moulders of fibreglass hulls, and they did anything from 80 foot to 80 foot. So they did patrol boats, and I fitted out a 38 foot Nelson class pilot boat for Sierra Leone Company. It went out to Sierra Leone as a pilot boat. And that was powered by two 240 turbocharged diesels, so it was quite an interesting thing. And I delivered this boat personally from Tollesbury to Rotterdam, and discovered that outcrossing was quite a lot quicker than the Harwich to Hook Ferry. So it's quite interesting. So we got to Rotterdam, and we didn't know where to go, and we were wandering around Rotterdam in this boat, effectively trying to find somewhere to hand it over and get back to the ferry terminal so we'd get back to England. But we never did show our passports or anything. So we arrived in this boat and wandered around Rotterdam, tried not to get run over by a few trams as they were zipping down the middle of the road, and then delivered the boat finally to some little dock somewhere, and then we got a car back to the ferry terminal, got on the ferry and back. No passports, no nothing. So the last project that I carried out in my sort of working life was the restoration of an 1882 former steamboat for Daimler, Daimler's museum in Stuttgart. I didn't even know Daimler had a museum at that time in Stuttgart. The boat was to be fitted with an original hot tube ignition Daimler engine of 1886, so very, very early marine petrol engine. In fact, it predated car engines or road engines. And this engine had been rebuilt by a Sussex firm to full running order. And the idea of the boat was that it was going to be a working exhibit on a lake at the museum in Stuttgart. And found out that the engine itself, they didn't run on petrol in those days because petrol hadn't been invented. They actually ran on naphtha. And they had a strange device called a surface carburetor, which was basically a tank at the back of the engine, a brass tank, that you heated. And naphtha's far more volatile than petrol. So this was kind of, they had a reputation of blowing up or catching light and things like that. And there was a chap called Frederick Sims who had a boat building business under the railway arches at Twickenham, I think. And he told the railway company he was building steamboats, and they were absolutely fine. When they discovered he was building boats and putting these newfangled petrol engines in, they revoked his lease, chucked him out. Anyway, I was nearly 65 by the time I was rebuilding this boat for the Daimler Museum, which was 9/10 complete. And unfortunately, I had a heart attack, so I decided it was the right time to retire, although obviously I still retain a great interest in the river. So,
how many boats do you think you've worked on in your lifetime?
I couldn't tell you.
Is it hundreds?
Oh yes, it must be. Over, I mean, some are more notable. I mean, I've missed out some boats I owned. I had a French-built fishing trawler that took 9 foot of water to float, and she was about 60 foot long, 18 foot wide, and she was all oak. Everything was oak. The planking, hull planking, the frame of the boat, the decks were oak, everything. And she had an engine room that was tiled with handrails around the engine and a 400 horsepower Scania, I think, driving it. But I had great plans of turning that into a schooner, but that didn't happen. And the boat itself was self-destructing. So I fortunately got rid of that. But I don't know, I'm not entirely sure how many boats I've owned myself or partly owned. But as for working on boats, I don't know. I don't know, hundreds. And quite often, sometimes I get employed to go and... The chap in Danbury, he used to say, look, I found a boat on in Exchange and Mart or in an advert, we go and look at it. So go up to Suffolk and look at this boat. One of them was a plywood water witch, 32 foot long, Morris Griffiths design, and it was quite poorly. So the bloke, I can't remember how much he wanted for it, so he put in a ridiculous offer and the owner accepted. So he then brought it back to Danbury. He got a big cottage on the house on Danbury Ridge. And he said, there it is, we'll put a cover over it, you can rebuild it for me, which is what I did. He then sold it. The next thing he said, oh, I found another one by the same designer, which I like better, on the Isle of Wight. Will you go and look at it? So all expenses paid, down the Isle of Wight, had a day on the Isle of Wight, and surveyed this boat. He did the same thing, put in a silly offer, chap about half the normal retail price. Chap accepted, fetched it back, and I rebuilt that at Hatfield Peveril in a barn for him. And then that particular boat was quite nice. Normally you sort of do the work on the boat, that's it, it goes out of your life. And that particular boat, he had it launched in Tollesbury. They put it in the marina. At the time I was living in Tollesbury, and they wouldn't let me work on it in the marina, even though I knew that I was a shipwright who lived in the village. And so I said, okay, fine. So I motored it out of the marina, took it round to one of the Fellowship of Flotile, who I knew quite well, moored it on that patch there alongside the quay, and then I finished off the boat. And then he said, would I deliver... He sold it. Then he said, would I deliver it to Woodbridge? So that was a nice little sail around the coast and being paid for it. So, you know, not all grief. Telegraph herself, I never generally sailed with a crew of four, but... quite often sailed it with only two of us, but then you have to be careful. Sailing a boat that weight, she weighs about 38 tonnes, and from the end of the bowsprit to the end of the boom is 82 feet. She's about 53 feet on deck. So, yes, it concentrates the mind, because you have to think ahead and you have to know the capabilities of the boat, by and large. You can't, basically, won't do something you can't, you know... You can't ask it to do something the boat can't physically do. And I suppose as you get to know the boat better, you know where the boundaries are better, and you can push them a bit. But and one day, and I sailed it a couple of times, just blowing down river with the wind with one sail set, but one day it was moored up Malden near the causeway. It was a lovely fine day, and I got food on board and no crew, and I thought, I'll blow it. So I managed to set most of the sails and sailed it down the river single-handed to Mersey, anchored off Mersey for the night. A friend came up in his little yacht and moored up, and then we went to shore, local pub there, and had a few beers. Came back the following morning. I got him to give me a hand to set the mainsail. He went off in his yacht. I had to tack telegraph all the way out the river single-handed, which I probably wasn't insured. I think the insurance would not have covered me. But fine, because she's a working boat with a long straight keel, it's got directional stability. So you'd put a line on the tiller to hold the tiller where you wanted it. And then I was basically letting the boat sail itself up the river, and I was leaning on the rigging by the mast, looking out ahead for anybody getting in the way, whatever. And then when you tack, you've got a line on it like a sailing barge to hold the foresail back to help the head come round. It's like an insurance. So I'd put the tiller hard over, lash the tiller hard over, walk forward again, the boat would come round through the eye of the wind. Once it came through the wind properly, release the foresail, walk back aft, take the tiller line off, straighten the tiller up, get the boat settled down again, tie the tiller up again, and then amble forward and let it get on with it, which is a good working boat will do that. A poor working boat would be demanding attention all the time. So in that, the old girl is very good, but I certainly couldn't do it now. Nor necessarily want to, but anyway, that's about it.
Lovely.
So the last steam train out, actually this is the last steam train into Maldon. And Maldon, the Maldon line originally was double track, and I'm told that it was actually singled, as they called it. They picked up one of the two tracks during the time of the Crimea War, and that track went out to the Crimea. So I'm told that's what happened. So all the bridges were built for two tracks, not one. So, but anyway, this is a picture of a steam train coming in. I can't remember the number. And it's got two coaches behind it. And because it was single line working, they had to have a token, which is usually the form of a round ring with a badge with some sort of key in it that maybe unlock points or unlock signals or something like that. But anyway, it's a round ring. And this particular picture, the signalman has just walked out across a wooden boardwalk from the signal box, and he's just receiving the token from the driver. Train would not be allowed to proceed without the token. So basically, when it was going out of Maldon Station, the fireman would probably hang out the train with the token, and the signalman would spear it, collect it on his arm, and the train would be allowed to proceed. And this is, of course, the reverse when they came in. So when they came off the single line section between Maldon and Witham, they would hand the token to the signalman as they came in. And anyway, I have a photograph of that. And it's brilliant. The last train on the last day of steam hauled traction on the line.
Brilliant. And you were at the station,
yes,
when the last train
yes, that was
left?
The last scheduled service, which is a bit different. And that was a two-coach diesel rail bus rather than the single rail bus. Single rail bus was brilliant. That used to do about... The driver sat in a little cubicle on one side, and you could stand there and look, a glass-sided cubicle, and you could stand there and look over his shoulder. There's a big speedo in the middle, and the track's pretty well dead straight, and he used to do about 70 miles an hour down the straight, and you'd see this big speedo sort of quivering away, and the track obviously coming towards you. And it used to cost half a crown, which was 12.5p, isn't it? And it used to take 8 minutes Maldon to Witham. So it was brilliant service. And that was on the four-wheel rail bus. The only thing about the four-wheel rail bus was coming out of the bends at Witham, it would sort of judder from side, because it only had four wheels, it was a judder from the wheels, so the motion was a bit uncomfortable, whereas the bigger diesel units had more wheels and they went round the corners better. But that, and then the last day, the very last train came in, it was dark. I can't remember the time of year, but it was dark, 9 o'clock or something, and it was a two-car diesel unit, and came in, all the passengers got off, doors shut, out the train went, the detonators exploded on the track, and then all the staff were sort of milling around and giving away tickets, because they suddenly realised they were out of a job, their job had finished. And they were just handing out tickets, you know, Maldon to Witham and so on. And a very good friend of mine, who's now sadly dead, he carried one in his wallet for about 30 years afterwards. I was a little jealous, because I could have had one, had I, just for the asking.
Thank you.
But this area here, I think it was part of the garden of Wentworth House, if I remember correctly. And by that time, Doe's had built the other side of the road, and they had their 1920s-style, 30s-style showroom. I've seen photographs of that before then, where there was a couple of little cottages down Fanbridge Road, which you probably have. But they wanted to build a showroom this side of the road. And so they had these boring machines here, cleared the site, and they boring holes in the shingly ground here. And to my surprise, the holes were about 4 foot in diameter, and they all filled up with water within about 6 inches of the top due to all the springs here. But you'd expect the lower holes to be higher, so the water was actually flowing out, but the water, the level of the water went down with the contour of the hill, which I found quite sort of surprising, really. Then they built their showroom, and before they moved in, they had an exhibition about Bradwell Power Station, telling you how good it was for you. And they had a pretend bar of uranium that you could hold up to a Geiger counter, and it went click, click, click. So it's probably about less radioactive than a fluorescent watch was, in fact. But they were telling you how beneficial it was going to be and so on, which is another subject. Then the showroom was here for many years. Cars were all stored at the back in a big gravel compound. And for my sins, for a little while, those on the other side, there were a Shell forecourt there serving petrol. And for my sins, I was between jobs on coasters, actually. And I worked there for about 3 months selling petrol, which was fairly soul-destroying. I do remember Geoffrey Ingleton. Ingleton's had a big wine merchants in one of Sand's old warehouses. And Geoffrey Ingleton had an old Rover 90, and he came down one day and I got the pump on automatic, and he drove off with the pump still in the car, and he ripped the hose right out of the pump, to my horror, shock horror. He did stop, because the hose and the filler was trailing along behind the car. So. But then, of course, Doe's got... I don't know why, but it must have been Alan Doe, one of those. He came in and showed me a cheque his sales office had just written out. I don't know why he showed me. I was serving petrol on the forecourt. He came and showed me this cheque. Look at that. And it was a cheque for about £14,000. And he said, that's trade price for a car. Oh, Ford car? And he said, no, I just bought a Jensen Interceptor, which was something a bit different. So he bought, had a, obviously his personal car was a Jensen Interceptor. But and then, well, Doe's were just sort of Doe's, really, weren't they? And they were there for years. It's a branch of the brother, wasn't it, I believe, of the Alting Does, who were all over the country, the agricultural does. So.
And you experienced the courtyard being built where we are now.
Yes, indeed. Because I remember they capped two or three of the springs, in fact, several of them, because there's lots of springs all over here. In fact, half of this was into the, built it over or into the Anglo-Saxon Burr, which goes down the hill as well. In fact, my next door neighbour, which will be number 14, he, for some unknown reason, instead of building a path up the contour of the hill, dug into the hill and built a flat path, and then built a greenhouse, which was largely buried in a hole in the ground. But he came up with boxes and boxes of arrowheads and all sorts of artifacts, which he just threw in a box somewhere and didn't want anybody to... He didn't want people in his garden. He just, you know, he just... So basically, he probably struck a trench, or made a trench right through the outer wall of the Burr, the Anglo-Saxon Burr. But they capped two or three of the springs here, and we were concerned, as there's supposed to be an underground stream runs from the springs down Spittle Road, and I can believe that because the Ware Pond always used to be overflowing, and there's a manhole covering the main road by the Ware Pond, and you come down late at night when it's quiet, and you could always hear the water pouring in into the drains underneath this underneath this manhole cover. So the springs must have been quite active. And anyway, they capped all of those, and we wrote a round letter from all the properties down there saying, basically, if our houses dry out and crack and fall apart, you're responsible to Countryside Properties. But they didn't, so it's very fortunate. So. Mm-hmm. Brush's Crane was built about 1961, and I'm told I should actually call it a derrick, not a crane, or it was a stiff leg crane, or a McPherson type crane is another term, I believe. Basically, it had two legs out at 90 degrees to concrete piers, and the legs were about 30 or 40 feet long, and then the main tower of the crane and about a 180, 200 foot jib. The grab was huge. I don't know how many cubic yards it was, but you could have put an old mini car inside it easily. And that was powered. There's no power down there. So they had a big 8-cylinder Paxman generator, the other side, the inside of the seawall, in its own little house they built. And the power cable, which was quite a heavy diameter, used to just run over the top of the seawall. And apparently it was 400 volts direct current. And it just literally, this cable ran over the top of the seawall to the crane. I mean, nowadays, you wouldn't be allowed to do anything like that. You'd trip over it. I mean, it was literally... So there's this huge generator, 400 volts, which is a lot, a DC, which is lethal because you can't let go, which is why they brought in alternating current. And when the crane was running, it sounded like an old-fashioned demented mangle, or a demented old-fashioned mangle. But the old-fashioned mangle that your mother had that you used to turn and made all the grunt noises with the gears, it sounded like that, only much, much louder. And it could load a coaster in half an hour, or perhaps 100, 150 tonnes in half an hour. Lorries used to come down the gravel pit and they'd dump the gravel or shingle or whatever it was in appropriate heaps. The crane, the actual crane worked over the seawall. So any pedestrians walking underneath look out. And then the coasters would lay off on a mooring barge. And originally they had a concrete barge that they sank there. And then they had an ex-sailing barge called the Lancashire that used to be, she was one of Eastwood's brick barges. She used to be moored in the middle of Basin Reach in 1960 after she'd been had an accident. They had her as a mooring barge alongside the concrete barge, and Brushy's Coasters used to come up and knock seven watsits of hell out of the poor old barge. And after about 6 months, she was leaking so badly, they towed her up the moored and dumped, chopped a hole in the side and left her there. And I saw it towed up there and actually photographed it before they buried it, and it's still there under the dump, I suppose. The crane itself, I've actually got a newspaper cutting which, by dint of detective work, I managed to track down from the Malden Burnham on its first day of operation. And the coaster that it's loading is the Paterna, which belonged to Civil and Marine, which was John Hobbins, who lived in Malden. And the skipper is sculling ashore in a dinghy, and he was called Scotty. And so I can place it, and I've got the exact date and the first day of operation is crane, which only operated for about 3 years. At the Paterna, well, that's another interesting thing, I talked for hours about this, was called originally an X-craft, and they were built for the Dardanelles landing in 1915, I think. And they had about 200 of them built, and dozens of them came back to England and were turned into motor barges and traded. So the Paterna was an ex-Dardanelles landing craft, and they had a peculiar bow which went like that, so for the angle of the beach, so they go into the beach like that. Some of them had horses in, some of them had troops, and others had supplies. And they were known as beetles, black beetles, because the hulls were invariably tarred. And because of this bow, somebody must have said it looked like an old beetle, so they were known as black beetles for years and years and years. And there's one or two of them still survive, amazingly. So,
doesn't matter. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Black beetles is another thing you could go on about for hours and hours and hours, but no. Or Ballarat Nugget. And that was the biggest gold nugget ever found in Australia in about 1870 at Ballarat. So somebody, and it obviously was in the news, so somebody had a fishing smack built and they called it Ballarat Nugget. But another one that I liked even more was Buy Your Own Cherries. What a name for a boat. And the apparently the lease of Bawley's, the fishing smacks. A Bawley is a corruption of boiler boat, and they used to have a boiler in them and cook the shrimps. They used to be shrimpers, basically. So they'd catch the shrimps, boil them, and then get them back and sell them. So they were, and it was corrupted to Bawley, which is what they're known as. And there used to be a trade of them going over to Kent, and they'd come back with fresh cherries from Kent. And you can just imagine the other local fishermen yelling, give us a few then, or whatever, mate, or whatever they said. And it was Buy Your Own Cherries. So that was what the boat was called. But if you go back further than that, some really weird names, like Air Balloon. Hot Air Balloon was one, I remember. Another one, Bat, B-A-T-T. And there were loads of boats. I mean, go back to 1780, 1820. There were loads of Friends Increase and things like that. And Five Brothers, Four Brothers, Three Sisters, Four Sisters. You know, loads of family sort of names. But other names were pinned to events. There was one fishing smack and a sailing barge called Santoy. And sadly, the sailing barge was sunk in the 20s, but the fishing smack survived up until about 5 years ago. And with a bit of research, nobody knew when the barge was built, but not the smack. And obviously, they some incident found there was a musical hit at the London Station about 1899 called Santoy, which is, there was a tiny village in America somewhere that was a mining village, but it obviously wasn't that. So it was the musical gave its name to... Mm-hmm. And another barge that was broken up at Bradwell was called Titbits. not probably after the paper that existed from about 1910 onwards, but because it was allegedly built over from little bits left over from several others. So it's...
Very good. Thank you.
The bottom boatyard was the bigger one with the bigger slipways, which is now where the marina is.
This is in Tollesbury.
This is in Tollesbury. Uh-huh. And they had a big pot of pitch, which they used for bedding on. Perhaps it would be put as a slightly flexible mastic under a keel or something, or various planks when they're being bedded on. It's a very traditional method. And some lady's long-haired cat came and lay on the pitch pot. They'd all gone home. They'd switched, the fire had gone out or whatever, they'd gone home. But the pitch was nice and warm, so the cat laid on it. But the pitch was unfortunately quite soft. So when they, and this was a long-haired cat, so when they came back in the morning, the cat was half sunk in the pitch and very angry. So I'm surprised they didn't have a pair of scissors on the firm or whatever, but the old boy told me, he said, well, they got a big wide chisel about 2 inches wide, sharpened it up, and then they shaved the cat's fur off. He said, we had to wear gloves because it was trying to claw our hands off. So anyway, eventually they shaved, so they got this chisel and was slicing the cat's fur off and trying not to cut the cat, obviously. And eventually this cat struggled free of the pitch and went up the road, but of course it was all bald on one side. And they said, I can't remember the lady's name who owned it. Don't know what old Mrs. So-and-so thought when her cat come home bald on one side.